All right. It's an interesting little passage here. I'll just sell a little bit of the context. This story, as many, perhaps most of the parables that are recorded in the book of Luke, are occurring in this middle section of the book where Jesus is on this journey from Judea all the way down to Jerusalem. And as he's on this journey and as he's interacting with people and telling these stories, crowds are gathering. And we talked about these crowds a couple weeks ago, right? We said that it's sort of mixed company. You've got people in the crowd who are very interested in Jesus. They have been convinced of his lordship and his authority, and they are wanting to follow him genuinely, and so they are there to hear what it is he has to say. There are some people in the crowd who are maybe curious. They're interested in Jesus. They're interested in this business of the kingdom that he is declaring and he is preaching, and so they are there to hear what he has to say. They're maybe not all in or not all out. They're not so sure yet. And then you have some people in the crowd who are just flat out rejecting and refusing Jesus, and maybe they're there for more malicious or ulterior motives, maybe trying to trip him up or to catch him in something that they can use to bring offense against him, you know, whatever it may be. And I think this short little passage has a very important and timely message for people in all three of those categories. And that's just basically my goal this morning as we work through the sermon. I want you to see the challenge that it brings to those who are genuinely interested in following Christ and living life faithfully as a servant to his kingdom. I want you to hear the word of encouragement and hope that it would hold out for those who are considering Christ. And you should also hear the word of warning that is in here for those who are refusing and rejecting Christ. Okay, so that's where we're going this morning. So let's talk about the first category there. Let's talk about the people who are enamored with Christ, who are convinced of his lordship and their need to follow him and are doing so. Let's talk about them for a second. And here's where I want to remind you of what's going on in this little journey from Judea down to Jerusalem. All right? Luke, we talked about this last summer, or I guess it was last spring. We spent some time actually in these chapters, and we pointed out that Luke, in distinction from one of the other gospel writers, he actually slows this journey down. Like if you read in Mark of the journey from Judea to Jerusalem, it's maybe like two chapters. Luke wants to slow it down. He spreads it over 10, 11 chapters because he really wants you to see he wants you to hear the conversations that Jesus is having along the way. He wants you to see the things that he's doing, how he's demonstrating the kingdom. Because for Luke, this whole journey, this is how Jesus is discipling his disciples. He's inviting them to come with him. Basically, he's going on a journey and he's saying to his disciples, hey, look, come follow me. Right? Watch how I demonstrate what kingdom life is all about. Listen and watch as I interact with people. Listen to the stories that I'm telling and come follow me. And actually, he gets them in on the act. And they join the proclamation of the kingdom as they are starting to go from village to village. I think it was last year when we were working through this passage, I said to you at one point that I've kind of soured on the term believer, right? It's a term that we often use to classify Christians. We say, you know, is he or she a believer? And I understand that, right? Because Jesus calls us to believe him and believe in the work that he has done. But I've become much more a fan of the term follower. See, because you can believe but not actually be following. Now, you can believe who Jesus is. You can believe in the historical person of Jesus. You can even believe that historically Jesus died and was raised to new life for sins, but not actually be following him. See, the difference is you can believe one thing, but to follow means that I actually trust him. It's that I actually trust that what he did is my only solution to the sin problem, and it is to have this confidence and this trust that with Christ is life to the full and is the pattern of how I am to live and conform my life. right? And as I trust that and I'm willing to entrust my life to it, then there's stake in the game, and now I pick up and I move and I follow him. Right? So I like that term, follower. And if I could push that just a little bit further, I would remind you that the big picture, what it means to follow Christ, I would say it this way. It doesn't simply mean that, okay, I adopt a certain moral code and I live a certain moral life. I choose certain moral behaviors just on my own in my own personal private walk with Jesus. That is certainly part of the picture. But the bigger picture is to follow Christ is to follow Christ, is to follow the King as he is on kingdom mission. Right? That's what the King is up to here. He's up to the business of the kingdom. He is up to building a church and growing it into his image and his reflection. He is up to proclaiming the good news of his kingdom to ears who haven't heard it or ears that have been resistant to it. If you look in Jesus' life and ministry, he's out there caring for the poor and the sick and the oppressed, right? Going into all the places, as the hymn says it so well, going as far as the curse is found to make his blessings known. And so here's the picture, right? To follow the King is to follow him into those areas and to be at the business of the kingdom or to be at the mission of the kingdom. Okay, so here's maybe then where we run into maybe a little bit of difficulty with what's going to be in this passage. Anytime we say, okay, I'm ready, put me to task, right? Let's get on mission here. I see there's a job to be done. It's an urgent job, so I'm going all in. I'm going to get it done. And when we go to work, well, then there's sort of like this expectation that there's going to be results. Suburban American professionals, right? We have learned that work that is rewarded is work that produces results, right? And so when we go to work, we devote our energy to getting a task done and accomplishing the task and seeing results and fruit from our labors. When we think about how we're going to invest our time at work, or even when we think about how we're going to relate to other people or who we're going to relate with and how we're going to do that, right? We have sort of the end game in view there. We have the results in view and the fruit that we expect is going to come from how we invest our time and how we relate with others. And then as good old-fashioned suburban Americans too, when you come home from work, you're stepping right back into another, more busyness. We've got music lessons and sport camps and church activities that we've got to, shuttle people around to. We've got responsibilities around the house. We've got family obligations, family get-togethers and dinner gatherings and all these things we've got to take care of. And anytime, we're starting to get busy like this, the golden word, at least for me, is efficiency, right? I want to invest my time in the things that are going to accomplish what I'm looking to accomplish, right? I want to pour myself and I don't want to waste time on things that aren't going to do anything. So I just have to admit, and I guess as I've sat with this passage a little bit in the back of the mind for the past 2 weeks, there's something a little bit unsettling to me about this gardener who comes and who sees this tree that hasn't been bearing fruit for 3 years. And I'd be like the guy who said, all right, let's just cut it down. And the vine dresser says, or the gardener says, no, hold on, let's just be patient. Let's give it another year. Let me dig around it, let me put some manure in it, give it some more nutrients, and let's see what happens in a year. that's a little tough for me. I love peaches and cherries, so I planted half a dozen peach trees over here in the property at the end of last year, beginning of this year. And in the spring, 4 out of 6 of them were looking pretty good. 2 of them didn't seem to make it through the winter. No leaves were coming out. Like, all right, out of here. Boom, pull them on out. Even now, I've got two little cherry trees out in the front here that are looking kind of scraggly. Every time I come into the driveway there, I'm looking at these trees and I think, are those trees going to make it or not? There's some little bit of green on there, but they're not looking so hot. Everything in me wants to just get in there and pull them out, but then there's something saying, well, I don't know, there's a little bit on there. So anyway, I'm that same way. I, I resonate with a guy who says, look, this thing hasn't bore fruit in 3 years. Let's chop it down. And I feel like I'll just readily admit that sometimes I struggle with impatience. and that carries over to when it comes to kingdom work as well, right? Every Sunday morning I get up and I go walk through the neighborhood, working through the sermon. And there are select houses along the way that I pray for the families there. I've been praying for those families for now, I don't know, some of them a couple years as I've been walking the same loop that I make. Some families that we have extended invitations to church to, I haven't seen them show up once. Some families who have tasted of the goodness of Christ, but don't seem all that interested in it right now. Some families who have been struggling with illness or debilitating physical conditions, we've been praying for God. God, would you heal them? Would you provide joy and peace and comfort to them? And sometimes it just seems like God is really slow to answer prayer. And sometimes I wrestle with that. I struggle with that. So I guess part of the challenge here, at least for me, is I hear a little bit in this message, hey, patience. I'm not exactly on your timeline here. I want to keep feeding this thing, and let's see what happens. I'll say, too, that sometimes that business of patience, when you are at kingdom work, gets even more difficult when you feel like you are facing resistance or hardship as you are going about that kingdom business. I have in here, as I was reading through this, I have in mind an episode that happened just a couple chapters earlier when they were beginning this journey from Judea to Jerusalem. They traveled through Samaria, and I'm assuming you heard of sometimes the tense relations between Jewish folk and Samaritans last week. Well, early on, as they're traveling through Samaria, Jesus and the disciples, they're proclaiming the news of the kingdom, and they're receiving opposition, or it's not received well. And you got James and John, the Zebedee brothers, who identify with, right? They're all in, they're fired up, they're preaching the kingdom, and when it's not coming back, they say, Lord, should we call down fire from heaven and just burn the place down and on we go? And Jesus, he rebukes them. That's actually a pretty strong word. I'm pretty sure up to that point in Luke, the only things Jesus had been rebuking were demons, right? He's in as strong a term as he can say, that's not what we're doing here. That's not the kingdom business at this point in time. And then he's going to go on to tell them later in that chapter and even further on down, you know, through this journey, hey, you're going to face opposition as you go about as a servant of this kingdom. As you go about proclaiming me as the king and what this kingdom is all about, just as the world is hating me, they're going to hate you as a result of that. Or you're going to find family, brother and sister, turning against one another on account of me and for my sake. You're going to face resistance and trial and heat, right? If you're going to move out of your personal private little bubble and you're actually going to move into this world that I'm trying to reclaim, this world full of violence, pride, discrimination, hatred, injustice, oppression, all these things, right? And if you go into that world and you start proclaiming a new kingdom and calling people to get a part of it, you rest assured you're going to face resistance. And now God's patience and his long-suffering mercy and his delay and his waiting becomes even more difficult. Right? Now you're calling me to be a faithful servant who's going out there, taking up the mission, and facing resistance and feeling the heat from a broken world as I'm doing that, and you're still waiting and being patient. This is difficult. I've been challenged a little bit by the prophet Isaiah, and I've noticed how often he uses the term wait. maybe most... most familiar, you can think Isaiah chapter 40, where how does he say here? Even youths faint and be, or shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. I think he's sort of the prophet of calling people to wait. And part of the reason that he does that is because Israel, they're terrible waiters. They have a very difficult time waiting. Most specifically, And this is part of the whole problem with Israel, as at that point in time, as they're seeing the threat of the Assyrian Empire mounting in the north, right? The call from the prophet is to wait on the Lord, wait for his salvation. But they can't. They're impatient. They feel the heat. They see the threat. And so what do? They go down and they make an unholy alliance with Egypt, because Egypt has fire. And so they make an unholy alliance with this. And this is all part of the process of them ultimately going into exile.